Well, good morning to everyone, and I want to say, as others have, that I'm thankful to be here, and thank you for the opportunity to be a part of the preacher study this year. Our subject for this hour is the qualification of elders in the Lord's church, and we're especially concerned about those domestic qualifications that relate to the elder's relationship with his wife and with his children. And the principal Bible verses that relate to this topic are found, I've noted them on the board, Titus chapter 1, verse 6, and what I will call a companion passage in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2, and verses 4 through 5. I think a good place to begin would be with the reading of these two passages together. So, Titus chapter 1 and verse 6 has this: "If a man is blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination." The King James Version says, "not accused of riot or unruly." And then also in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2, the Bible says, "A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife." Then skipping down to verse 4, "one who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God?" Now, our plan today, Lord willing, will be to consider as thoroughly as possible two principal issues. One is the significance of the phrase, "the husband of one wife." And then secondly, the meaning and the implications of the phrase, "faithful children." I think I would like to begin by just addressing this word, "must," which is found both in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2, and also Titus chapter 1, verse 7. The word "must" is found in the phrase, "the bishop must be blameless." This is the Greek word, dia, if I pronounce it correctly. And Thayer defines the word as meaning it is necessary, there is need of, it behooves, is right and proper. He says it denotes any sort of necessity. So in this passage, the word "must" the word "di" is translated by the English word "must," and I believe it implies the necessity of following these qualifications. These aren't things in the realm of optional matters, but I do think it's critical that we understand and properly apply what these qualifications are setting forth. Both in Titus and in 1 Timothy, Paul says the elder is to be the husband of one wife. And as you might expect, there are a number of interpretations about the significance of that phrase. Some believe that Paul's intent was to forbid polygamy, the situation where one man has more than one wife. Some believe that it forbids digamy, that is, a second marriage. And the word digamy may refer to any second marriage, regardless of whether the first wife died or she was put away scripturally for fornication. Or digamy may be defined as a second marriage following divorce for some reason other than fornication. In the literature, as you read and consider the word digamy, you need to understand how the person who's using it has defined it. And then there are some people, of course, who question whether this phrase actually requires a man to be married at all. What the passage says is that a man who would be an elder is to be mios gynekos andra. Again, I'm guessing, obviously, the pronunciation of that. But literally, in the Greek, the phrase is "one woman man." And the word "one" is from a Greek cardinal numeral, mios, which Thayer defines this way, used universally, he says, in opposition to many, secondarily, and emphatically, so that others are excluded. It is the same as a single. That's on page 186. Arndt and Gingrich define it similarly as meaning single or only one. And the translations that are available to us bear this out. J.B. Phillips' translation says he must be married to one wife only. Another version says one wife's husband. The New English Bible says faithful to his one wife. So again, the literal word-for-word translation of mios gynekos andra is one woman man. But whenever the marriage relationship is clearly under consideration, as it is here, it means the husband of one wife, or a man of one woman. And I think there are a number of conclusions that are easy to draw from this qualification. First of all, the elder is to be a married man. A bachelor cannot be an elder. A woman cannot be an elder, in spite of the denominational practice to ordain women to the eldership. And frankly, I was amazed in the reading that I did at the number of reputable commentators who took this phrase and said it does not necessarily require an elder to be married. A number of them merely asserted the fact, this doesn't mean what it seems to clearly be saying, but there was one in particular who actually made a case for that position. I want to share that with you because I think it's important to be able to deal with it. As an example of this thinking that this phrase, one woman man, does not mean he has to be married, I want to quote from Don DeWelt. Most of you will recognize that name. He wrote a book, The Church and the Bible, published by College Press. And lesson 9 is about the eldership. And on pages 105 and 106 of that book, he writes these words. It's not a very lengthy quote, so please bear with me. There has been a good bit of discussion over this verse as to whether this would exclude a single man from the office. The following should be carefully considered before a decision is reached. And he mentions 3 points I'd like to share with you. Number 1, the grammatical construction, both in the Greek and the English, does not suggest this exclusion. I'm going to stop in the quote there long enough to say that if the phrase, an elder must be a one-woman man, does not at least suggest that exclusion, then words mean nothing at all. It's beyond me how a man of learning could make that statement that it doesn't at least suggest that exclusion, which I certainly advocate. But then continuing the quote, he says, the Greek word for husband of one wife could be literally translated a one-woman man. Not that he must be married, but if he is, he should not be a polygamist, but a one-woman man. From the English construction, it would not be necessary to use the modifier one if all that is intended is that a man must be married. Again, I'll stop the quotation long enough to make a couple of comments. First of all, I do not believe it is the case that all that is intended is that the man be married. You know, in our culture today, we see same-sex marriages and we see multiple marriages over and over again. And if all that was the case was that the man be married, there are a lot of situations that would fulfill that qualification. But the very reason why the modifier one is necessary is because there is a specific type of marriage that is to be involved here. To one. There's one marriage involved. And then further, if Paul's words in this place, a one-woman man, forbid more than one wife, it just as clearly forbids less than one. He's to be a one-woman man. No more than that and no less than that. Then DeWelt goes on to say on page 106, this is his second point, the moral conditions of that time were such that polygamy was practiced by many outside and even some inside of the church. The terminology used by Paul was for the purpose of preventing this evil practice. And I won't debate that too much. There is some discussion on that. But number 3, most importantly, listen to this one please. John the Apostle was an elder, he affirms, DeWelt does, and cites 2 John verse 1 and 3 John verse 1, where John refers to himself as the elder. In one place he says the elder to the elect lady and her children. In another place the elder to the beloved Gaius. And he says from this that it is evident, or in addition to this, let me go back to the quote. John the Apostle was an elder, and it is evident that he remained single. He was left a son to a desolate mother, according to John chapter 19. And Tertullian, the writer, spoke of John in this manner. Here he quotes Tertullian. Here, too, we may without much hesitation accept the traditions of the church as recording an historic fact when they ascribe to him a life of celibacy. We conclude, therefore, that a single man may hold the office, but a married man must have only one wife. That's where the quote ends. Now, my comment about that is that with regard to John's usage of the term the elder, I would just ask you to see the comments of Brother Wayne Fussell in his commentary on Contending for the Faith series. Also, Guy N. Woods in his Gospel Advocate commentary and Burton Kaufman all deal with that to show that the expression the elder in this place was very likely not used in an official capacity, but that John was intending to show only his agedness and very likely to indicate that he was probably the last surviving apostle when he wrote those epistles. But to my way of thinking, this is extraordinarily weak and presumptuous evidence upon which to say, especially in light of Paul's words, a one-woman man, in light of that, it's presumptuous to draw the conclusion that a single man could be an elder. I'm going to maintain that the first thing to be concluded from this is that an elder must be a married man. The second conclusion has to do with the prohibition of marriage in the Catholic Church. And just briefly, I'll say that in the years following the first century, it became very popular, the idea that there was more holiness in celibacy than there was in Christian marriage. And that led the Roman Catholic Church to forbid their bishops to marry. And it's interesting just to point out that what the Apostle Paul strictly required for bishops, the Roman Catholic Church forbids for their bishops. And then the third obvious conclusion that I think can be drawn is that polygamy, that is a man with more than one wife, would disqualify a man as an elder. Such a man would also be disqualified from being a faithful member of the church, though, one who's living in polygamy. The real issue, I think, for us today is to try to determine what exactly Paul is dealing with in this phrase, in this qualification. Is it meant to deal primarily with the immoralities associated with marriage, that is, things like concubinage or polygamy? Is it dealing primarily with second marriages, including those after the death or divorce of a spouse? Or just what is it that was in view here? Well, the context of both 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1 is one in which the character of the man who would be a bishop is being discussed. What kind of man is he? Kenneth Wiest said, since character is emphasized by the Greek construction, the bishop should be a man who loves only one woman as his wife. David Lipscomb, in his commentary on Titus 1 and 6, said the phrase means having one wife only and faithful to her, a faithful husband. Now, I share these two comments as being representative of my thinking that if we're not careful, we can overlook the type of husband the man is while focusing on the number of marriages he's consummated. The one-woman man indicates an attitude that this man has about love and marriage. In the Contending for the Faith commentary on 1 Timothy chapter 3, Paul Walker posed this question. He said, is it possible for a man to be married to the same woman for 50 years and not really be a one-woman man? I think so, end quote, and I also think that is true. A man might be faithful sexually, and that's usually where we place most of the emphasis, the focus, but he may not have been a faithful provider materially for his wife. He may have not provided for her emotionally. He may have been a great communicator at work, but a very poor companion to his wife at home and insensitive to her needs. And so I do not in any way intend to downgrade the obvious meaning of one wife in this passage, but I do believe the greater significance of the qualification is seen in the way the husband is committed to his wife and the relationship that he sustains with her. It's that relationship that will qualify him as an elder. And every elder, this is the point I would draw from that, every elder must be above reproach in his marital life and in his sexual life. Now, the importance of that qualification, I think, is evident, and it's due largely to the nature of the work of shepherding a congregation. In the nature of shepherding a church, if the work's done correctly and it's done zealously, an elder is going to spend considerable time with both men and women. So it's critical that the elder be a one-woman man, and that his relationship with his wife be healthy and honorable, so that, number one, he won't be tempted to, or be tempted by others, I'll say. And second of all, so he'll be better able to counsel those who are young married couples or those who are prospective couples, those who are contemplating marriage. Now, I've been asked to deal with a few questions specifically, so I'd like to try to turn my attention to that at this point. Does the phrase one wife mean one living wife, one wife at a time, thus forbidding a polygamist? Well, clearly, I've already mentioned that this requirement of one wife forbids polygamy, but I don't really believe that was the main thing that the Apostle Paul had in mind. There are numerous commentators who affirm that that's exactly why he said that. This is the main reason why he put the words there. But there are other historians who deny that polygamy was widely practiced because it was in violation of Roman law of that day. In spite of that, there's substantial evidence that the law was fairly lax concerning the practice of polygamy. William Barclay said that Ovid and Pliny had three wives, Caesar and Antony had four, Sulla and Pompey had five, and Herod had at least nine. And Kittle's Theological Dictionary on page 780 mentions some of these same marriages. James McKnight, in a footnote for 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2, said that polygamy was common in the world of that day, the world of that time. So his paraphrase of the passage is the husband of one wife at a time. And A.T. Robertson, in his Greek work, also says one at a time clearly. Now, while it's evident that a polygamist is not acceptable elder material, it's not so clear to me that polygamy is really the thing that Paul had in view here. Alford said that the Apostle Paul would not have stipulated a specific requirement for an elder that was also required of all other Christians. Why specify this for an elder when this was a qualification to be a Christian in the first place, not to be a polygamist? It seems to me that it's been thoroughly established, a thoroughly established doctrine in the New Testament, that there is to be one woman and one man in Christian marriage. And in the interest of time, I will cite some passages just now without actually reading them. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 2 through 3, and Ephesians chapter 5, verse 31, as well as others, indicate that there's to be one man with one woman in a Christian marriage. So again, why would Paul stipulate that an elder could not be a polygamist when no Christian could be a polygamist? The second question that I was asked to deal with is, how does this apply if his first wife died and the elder remarries? Well, in answer to this, I think, first pose the question, does the death of an elder's wife disqualify him? Must he resign? If an elder's wife dies, is he no longer qualified or able to shepherd the flock? Well, scripturally and literally and technically, he is still a one-woman man. It would still be the case, literally, that he was the husband of one wife. And as others have said before me, I don't see anything scripturally or logically that would disqualify an elder at that point, at the death of a spouse, because that does not alter the character or the reputation or the influence of the man who at one time had met that qualification. It hasn't changed his character or his influence. Now, some might argue that he's no longer able to show hospitality as before. His home is no longer the kind of place that it was before his wife died. Well, I think that too depends upon the man to some extent. I know of a number of men of elder age who are able to straighten and clean and keep a house and prepare meals and by their own hand, if necessary. There are catering services available. There are restaurants available where this general nominal aspect of hospitality could still be met in such a home. Yes, the loss of a wife would affect that. Does it destroy it? I do not believe that it does. That depends upon the man. But the second part of the question was, what if he remarries? Well, the Revised Standard Version of 1946 rendered the phrase one woman man this way, married but once. But then a later version or a later edition of the Revised Standard changed that wording because there was no support for that reading in the Greek language. That's not what the Greek text says, and it's not what it requires. What Paul taught, is that the Apostle Paul did teach that a widow may remarry with this stipulation to be only in the Lord, according to 1 Corinthians 7, verse 39. In Romans chapter 7, in verses 2 through 3, Paul used this same principle when he talked about those who had been married to the law, and he pointed out that the law had passed away and had died, and he said, you're no longer bound to that old law because it's dead, and now you're free to marry another. And he directed them to the idea of spiritual marriage to Christ. And then in 1 Timothy chapter 5, in verse 14, that was 1 Timothy 5 and 14. Paul specifically said, therefore I desire that the younger widows marry and bear children to manage the house and give no opportunity to the adversary to speak reproachfully. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 4 is where Paul, or the writer of Hebrews, says that marriage is honorable in all. And if it is true that marriage is honorable in all, I believe that would include a faithful elder. So I would affirm then that the death of a spouse is no disqualification for an elder in the first place, and that if he chooses to remarry in the Lord, that also would not disqualify him in that he's following scriptural precedent there. If you would consider a hypothetical situation, and I realize that hypothetical situations prove nothing. They illustrate and they help us to kind of focus a little bit. So I'd like to present a hypothetical situation. There is a man, ordained an elder, who has raised his children in an exemplary manner. Everybody who knows him will attest to his fatherhood, that he is above reproach, that he is loved and respected by his children, and all of them are model Christians. But as things happen, one day all of his children are killed in a tragic accident on a family outing. Now, yesterday he had faithful children. Today he does not. Does that therefore disqualify that man from shepherding the flock? Has that affected his ability in some way to shepherd the flock of God? I believe no, it does not. And similarly, I would say the death of a wife, all of the things remaining the same, does not disqualify an elder. And if he follows biblical teaching to remarry in the Lord, that also should not disqualify him. Nor do I believe he should rush out. Is he obligated to go out and remarry? Just as I do not believe he's obligated to father additional children in order to be reinstated, to take the place of those who were killed. One other point that I'd like to address in this connection is this. The position has been embraced by some in our brotherhood based on the Greek word meos, which is translated one in both of our passages, that this word means, or it can mean, first. Therefore, an elder is to be a man of the first wife. I'd like to talk about that just for a minute. Mia is found seven times in the New Testament, and this according to Strong's exhaustive concordance, so I'm assuming it's correct, but seven times in the New Testament with reference to the first day of the week. And in every case, the actual Greek phrase is the Mia, the one of the week. The word day is not there in the original. Translators have supplied the word day to complete the sense, and that's why it's called the first day of the week. But in the Greek, it's the one of the week. One other time in the New Testament this word appears where it's translated with the English word first. That's Titus chapter 3, verse 10, where it's in reference to a first admonition given to a sectarian man. And there the literal admonition, or the literal phrase, is a sectarian man after mia, after one, and a second admonition, reject. This word, if you want to look at it further, is found in Strong's concordance. It's number 3391, and he defines it as meaning one or first. It can mean either one, as is evident in these places. But the same word appears in a lot of other places, and again, in the interest of time, I'll mention these very briefly. Luke chapter 9, verse 33, where Peter said, "Let us build here three tabernacles, one for thee, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah." John 10 and 16, "There shall be one fold," Jesus said. Acts 4 and 32, "The multitude of those who believed were of one heart and one soul." 1 Corinthians 6 and 16, Paul quoted Genesis 2 and 24 when he said, "Two, saith he, shall be one flesh." 2 Corinthians 11, 24, Paul said, "Five times received I 40 stripes, save one." And then the word is used also of Jesus in Hebrews 10, verse 12, when he said, "This man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins." In all of these places, and a host of others, the obvious meaning of mia is one, not first. It is not necessarily meant to convey one in a list or first in order. It just means one. So, based upon Strong's concordance, again in his lexicon, mia appears at least 68 times in the New Testament. The root word appears many more times than that, the root word meaning, again, one. And the overwhelming majority of cases, the clear meaning of the word is the number one, not the word first. In fact, there are other Greek words that mean first in order. There are other Greek words that imply a beginning in a series, and I think these words would have been used if that had been the intent of the phrase. The word proton, protos, and I have a number of examples if we'd like to look at those later. But if Paul had meant to say he must be a man of the first wife, he could have said that. There are words which mean that. But I reject the idea that the word one, mia, in 1 Timothy and Titus implies the first wife, therefore forbidding a second marriage after the death of his wife. I don't believe that argument can be sustained to forbid marriage after the wife dies. Zur, in his commentary, pointed out that some say this phrase, one woman man, means never married but once, and which is not the literal translation of it. That would be quite a bit of commentary there in interpreting it that way, or in translating it that way. But he also said that some regard the phrase to be at the beginning of this verse as being rendered having been. And you don't have to be an English major to see the difference in those two phrases. One puts the meaning in the present tense, and one puts it in the past tense, including everything that has happened in the past. The Greek interlinear has the phrase in the present tense, and an elder is to be a one-woman man. Zur goes on and gives this other theory that the phrase one-woman man means one wife only. But he says that that third word only is added without any authority from the original because there's no word in the Greek text to justify that. And then again, to say that for in the case of an elder, he must have one wife only in the sense that he could not remarry upon the death of his spouse. Let me go back and say this again. To say that... To stipulate that an elder must be a man of one wife only would at least suggest that the church had in its fellowship certain men who were not husbands of one wife only, and that the practice of polygamy was countenanced or accepted in some places, and of course we do not believe that is the case. No man had the right to have more than one wife. Well, that leads us to the third question, and that is, does it forbid a man who has been divorced if he had the exception? Now, my comment here is that I believe, personally, that divorce and remarriage, whether people construe it as having been scriptural or not, has always been a greater threat and a greater problem in the Lord's church than polygamy ever was. It was generally believed among the Christians that polygamy was wrong. And historians tell us that many became or came to feel that same way about second marriages, in spite of what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 7:39, that a widow could marry again only in the Lord. M.R. Vincent said the opposition to second marriage became very strong in the latter part of the second century. Of course, that's well after the New Testament was written, but it suggests a trend that this was already growing early on. Now, I understand this qualification to teach against the practice of divorce that was so common in New Testament days. And I'm very careful, I'm going to try to be very careful in stating my thinking and my understanding of this. It seems to me that it's just in our nature, in the aftermath of a broken marriage or a broken marriage relationship, to assume that there's been some degree of fault on both sides of that marriage. We assign a certain amount of responsibility to that broken marriage, to both parties in it. That's not to say that there's ever an excuse for adultery, but the party that we call the innocent party generally shares part of the blame for that failed marriage. And if it be the case that an elder's wife is unfaithful to him, I believe it would cast some doubt upon his ability to manage well his household. I remind you that in both lists there's this one overarching qualification that an elder must be above reproach. He must be blameless. That is, just means the man cannot be charged with wrongdoing or be impeached in the sense of a charge being proven against him. And, of course, in both lists, the very first specific character virtue is that he be the husband of one wife. And so taken together, that is the principle that both parties of a failed marriage share some blame, and that the fact that an elder is to be blameless, I believe that a divorced man is precluded from the eldership even if he claims the exception. it cast a reflection, I believe, upon his how he conducted that marriage or his contribution to it. The Living Word commentary has this regarding this idea: his marriage must not be a second marriage that violates God's will. And this would apply to all Christians, especially to those who were appointed to be teachers and examples to other members of God's family. This would not imply that God's standard for a bishop is higher than for other Christians, but it does suggest that the officially ordained teachers of the church must not only teach, but also exemplify the sound words of our Lord Jesus Christ and the teaching which accords with godliness. That's where the quote ends. My comment basically upon that is that I believe, though, that God's standard for bishop is a little bit higher. Not necessarily morally, but James chapter 3 and verse 1 has that we are not many to be made teachers because we shall receive the greater condemnation. There's a stricter judgment, I believe, that falls to those who are elders or leaders in the church. And so I would say, yes, the standard, if in nothing more than degree, if only in the matter of degree, yes, we do expect elders to be a cut above the rank and file members of the Lord's church, if you'll permit me to use that colloquialism. So my answer to the question number 3, in the case of a divorced man, which I believe is the principal application of the phrase, is that a second marriage, even if the exception is claimed, disqualifies a man from serving as an elder, and at the very best, it makes it inexpedient for him to serve. Kaufman quoted the commentator Ward this way. He said, "Above reproach dominates the whole list." And so anything that is reprehensible in the marital relations of a prospective elder would certainly disqualify him. And I agree with that. I now want to turn our attention to the other domestic qualification mentioned in these verses. That is the elder's relationship with his children. And I'll attempt to answer, or at least address, a few questions. First of all, what is meant by faithful children? Second, must all of the elders' children be faithful Christians? And third, does the word children require more than one child? Well, we ought to begin, first of all, by just acknowledging the divine wisdom of this qualification. One author that I read after had this to say. He mentioned that the Puritans referred to the family household as the little church. And you know, I think this perspective of the family being the little church, or the church in microcosm, the church in miniature, is in keeping with the scriptural reasoning that if a man cannot shepherd his family, he can't be expected to shepherd the extended family of the church. And we understand by experience, I think, and by a biblical learning, that shepherding the church is more like guiding a family. It's more like managing a family than it is any other thing that you might attempt to do. It's not like running a business. It's not. In fact, a man might be a very successful businessman. He might be a capable public servant of some kind. He might be a brilliant office manager or a heroic veteran of the armed services, a military leader, but he might be a terrible father and therefore a terrible elder. So a man's ability to oversee and guide and manage his family household well is a prerequisite for overseeing the household of God. I liked what David Lipscomb said: the family is the nursery of the church, and these two act and react upon each other so that a bad or weak father can never be an efficient elder. I think it's fair today to say that Christian man's family is God's proving ground. It's like Elder University, we might say. It's a place of testing to see whether he should be entrusted to serve as a steward or overseer of God's family. What Paul is saying here is that a man's ability to keep his children submissive and respectful is the very thing that causes us to believe in his ability to do the same thing in the church, to guide God's family, to be submissive and to be respectful of God's authority, and to follow God's will in all of their relationships with each other. Going back to our lesson text in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4, Paul says, "One who rules his own house well, having his children in submission." The word submission, or sometimes translated in subjection, implies subordination. This is the word used in reference to the wife's submission to her husband in Titus chapter 2, verse 5. And interestingly, it's the same word that is used to describe the obedience of Jesus to his parents at Luke chapter 2 and verse 51. Now, in the context of 1 Timothy chapter 3, I want to also point out that Paul had already written a letter to the church at Ephesus, where we believe that Timothy was now serving. And in that letter, he admonished children to obey their parents in the Lord, and he admonished fathers to bring up their children in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord, according to Ephesians 6, 1 through 4. And so this qualification follows some teaching specifically on that point. And I think what follows is the idea that there must be some evidence that a man has put that teaching into practice in his household. The word gravity, or translated respectful or reverence in some places, was used by Paul at 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2, to describe the life of every Christian in their relationship to kings and to those in positions of authority. He said that we might live a quiet and peaceful life, godly and respectful in every way. Of course, the very first place that a child receives any kind of training that would lead to this lifestyle is in the home. If a child doesn't learn to respect authority and to be reverent in the home, they very likely will never learn to demonstrate it in their relationships to church leaders or in school or in society in general. If a man's children are open to the charge of being profligate and insubordinate, according to Titus chapter 1, verse 6, then that's an evidence, I believe, of his inability to teach and thoroughly exemplify the will of Christ and the rule of Christ in his own family. The first question I was asked to consider, what does the phrase faithful children mean in Titus chapter 1 and verse 6? Does it mean faithful Christians, or does it mean trustworthy children to their father? Well, again, Zur in his commentary gives a pretty concise treatment of these two views. He points out that many of the lexicographers define this word faithful as being faithful to Christ, one who has been converted to Christ. But then he adopts the second view and says that it's actually a reference here to the children's relationship to their daddy, because he sees that as the main point in this passage, the father's ability to control the child and command their respect. There are numerous other commentators who quote Thayer to prove that the word pista here, which is the word for faithful, means one worthy of trust, one that can be relied upon. They maintain that the word does not necessarily mean a member of the church. Those who embrace the view say that Titus 1:6 and 1 Timothy 3 are like parallel passages, and that faithful children in Titus 1:6 is the same thing as being in subjection back in 1 Timothy 3. Those are parallel ideas there. Burton Kaufman happens to embrace this view. Well, the word believer, pista, in this place, which along with children can literally be translated believing children or faithful children, is possible, I believe, in the Greek language, that it can indicate the relationship of the child to the elder as his father, suggesting the idea of trustworthiness and loyalty to a parent. On the other hand, it's very easy to prove that the word is synonymous with being a Christian. And there are a number of examples that we could set forth, biblical examples that show this word faithful or believing is used to describe one who's been converted to Christ. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 2 is where Paul said, "And those who have believing masters, let them not despise them, because they are brethren." Believing in that place, we believe, is the synecdoche, suggesting that those people have been baptized. They're believers in the New Testament sense of being a Christian. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 3, chapter 4, verse 10 are other places where the word believing is used to describe a Christian. And also in Acts 10, verse 45, the leaders of the Jerusalem congregation who attended or who accompanied Peter to Cornelius' house were, it says of them, those of the circumcision who believed. The term believed, again, means that they were Christians. So whether the word means trustworthy and reliable or means one who's a Christian is determined by the context. And it's evident that the context in both of these passages implies a relationship of a child to his father. It implies the necessary obedience to a father, but I believe the context here implies more than that. I believe that it says more than that. Look at the words that follow, especially in Titus chapter 1 and verses 6 and 7. Titus chapter 1, verse 6. Having faithful children, not accused of dissipation. The King James says riot. The other translations say not accused of being a profligate or insubordination. Now this word profligate, it's dissipation in the New King James Version, just means wasteful. It's the opposite of, or the negative of, being one who saves. And so it suggests that these were people who were old enough to be Christians. If they could be charged with being wasteful and lavish, or be accused of being riotous, then I believe they were old enough to be Christians. This word for profligate is the word used in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 18 in describing the conduct of one who was drunk with wine. It's also used in Luke 15 and 13 of the prodigal son who was guilty of loose living. And so it seems safe, to my way of thinking, to conclude that children who are old enough to conduct themselves in this manner, who are old enough to be accused of riot, are old enough to obey the gospel and embrace the Christian faith with its high moral demands. Also, the word for insubordinate, unruly in the King James Version, means undisciplined and rebellious. It's used in 1 Timothy 1, verse 9, to describe those who were lawless. And this, too, suggests to me the idea that if these people were old enough to recognize authority and reject it, then they are clearly old enough to recognize authority and embrace it. Thank you. And if they're old enough to do that, then I believe they were old enough to recognize the ethical requirements of the Christian life. And so in this context, I'm convinced that the use of the word believers is in the sense of being a Christian and not just being loyal to their father. That's the correct view. I think Don McCord made a valid observation in a sermon published in the Old Paths Pulpit several years ago. He said, "I cannot understand how my children can be faithful to me only, if that is what the word means here, and not be faithful to God, as is by some contended. This is an incongruity of the first order." And that just says that if a father teaches his children the word of God, then their faithfulness to him and their respect for his influence will guide them to embrace and obey that teaching, thus also becoming a child of God. So I'm of the persuasion that an elder's children are to be Christians, at least those who are old enough to be Christians, and that he must have at least one that is old enough to be a Christian. The second question as to their faithfulness, is a father responsible for the faithfulness or other conduct of children after they have become adults? In other words, if a man's adult child becomes unfaithful, is he thereby disqualified? Well, again, I would say that the context of both passages relates to a father's relationship with his children and the management of his household. Some scholars point out that this word children normally refers to those who have not yet attained adulthood. I think the conduct in view here is that of children at home, and adult children who have left is not under consideration, to my way of thinking. Now, all of us, I think, recognize the fact that once we're born, we're always the biological offspring of our parents. We're always children in that sense, but there comes a time in human experience that a person is no longer regarded as a child. There comes a time when we become a man or an adult. Paul recognized it. He said, "When I became a man, I put away childish things." And there is likewise a time when a youngster is part of their father's household, and there's a time when they establish their own household and become responsible for themselves. Zur says that the word house in 1 Timothy 3 verse 4 is from the Greek word oikos, which Thayer defines as the inmates of a house, all the persons forming one family, a household. And so the qualification Paul gave to Timothy was that a man rule well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. And I think the question is, when are they considered members of his house? When does he rule over them or have them under his authoritative subjection? It is when they are part of that household family unit. And so from there I would make this statement. I do not believe that we should make a blanket judgment, unqualified, that if an adult child of an elder leaves the church or is deemed to be no longer faithful, that that man is thereby disqualified to serve. Robert Taylor, in his book, The Elder and His Work, had this: an elder is responsible for his children as long as they are under his rule at home. He's responsible for their behavior and the training he gave them while they were under his leadership. If they were Christians then and were faithful in the same while under his influence, then he met the qualifications set forth in the Timothy and Titus tables of eldership requirements. It seems grossly unfair to say of any man who has a son or daughter 40 or more years of age and who has been gone from home for 20 or more years, who is now not faithful as should be the case, that this godly elder can no longer serve. Yet this same son or daughter was faithful to the Lord all the days he or she lived under the roof of the Father, end quote. A couple of comments before I hasten to close. We all wrestle with this issue of the apparent unfairness of this, and the idea that it's troublesome to us to think that somebody who's been in the office for a number of years and then an adult child steps out of line and leaves the church, that this somehow is unfair. This, I believe, is where wisdom and church autonomy must be relied upon. And the question I would pose is, do the actions of that adult child affect the man's ability or his reputation in the church? And I would also ask, how does he deal with it? Does he countenance that behavior, or does he rebuke it openly and stand against it? Obviously, there would be circumstances that would warrant an elder's resignation or his removal in such cases involving an adult child. Perhaps we can discuss that a little bit more later. But I would just say this, that they should be considered on their own merits and within the local congregation. And I think that we should not place them all in a blanket category without considering those circumstances and whether or not those circumstances in any way mitigate the departure of that adult child. Yes, I realize it creates problems if an adult child departs from the faith later in life, but I do not believe that necessarily and automatically disqualifies a man. The last question, I think I've got a couple of minutes. Must an elder have more than one child? No. That's two pages worth of notes. The word is used generically and specifically. I reject the notion that the word children in this place necessarily requires a multiplicity of children. What's in view is how he handles the child or children that he does have. And I've got a number of biblical examples that I think will bear that out if it comes up in the questions later. Let me summarize by saying this, and these I'm just paraphrasing the words of David Lipscomb here. A man who knows how to train children and lead them in the right way in a kind and gentle manner so as to make worthy men and women of them is exercising the qualities given here for the bishop. The same qualities are needed for the proper training of a family that are needed for the training of a congregation, so his management of his family is the evidence of his ability to lead the church. I think I'm over time, so thank you very much.